Welcome to Monster, DC Sniper, a production of iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the podcast author or individuals participating in the podcast and do not represent those of iHeartMedia, Tenderfoot TV, or their employees. Listener discretion is advised.
Somebody got shot at Spider-Phil Sunoco.
Okay, somebody got shot.
The guy is dead.
He's laying there, man.
He's laying on the car. And there was a white van just went by with two guys in it. The van just went back, now it's going forward. He's getting on the 234 right now, the white van.
Okay, wait.
No, there he goes. He's going down. He's going down 234.
Towards which direction?
1466.
Okay, so I'm typing the information. We have the officers on the way. I just have to give them information.
I got a call in the evening on October 9th from a source saying, you need to get out to Manassas. There's been another one.
This is Washington Post reporter Josh White.
There was nothing more than that. I was given a location. I knew the area, so I knew that they would have shut down the intersection right by the gas station. So I went past the gas station, got off onto a side road, and came up the back way. And I thought, well, if you wanted to get a really good view of the crime scene, you would go up onto this hill. There was a Bob Evans that overlooked the gas station from across the road. Standing there on that hill and looking down at that crime scene, it was lit up at night. Somebody standing there would have been framed fully in light. It's like a lit up target with a million access points. They had shut down the parking lot and they were interviewing everyone who was leaving. I drove up and I got into an adjacent parking lot and I walked right to where I thought would be the best view. That too was something that the snipers realized, that was the best view of that gas station, because I'm fairly certain I stood directly next to the vehicle that they had been using to kill tons and tons of people facing the gas station below.
There is a ruthless person on the loose.
What unnerves this community the most is the randomness of the murders. Ordinary people doing ordinary things.
They killed the five people in one day and then went on the rampage for the next month.
It is quite a mystery. The police say they have never had a crime quite like this.
Be careful. These guys are using weapons that are going to go right straight through our bulletproof vests.
There's a white van just went by with two guys in it.
From iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV, this is Monster, DC Sniper.
Nine sniper attacks in 8 days have the Washington metropolitan area on high alert. Since last Wednesday, seven people have been killed and two wounded. One was a 13-year-old boy who was critically wounded at a Maryland middle school. The latest shooting took place just after 8 o'clock last night, about 30 miles west of Washington, D.C.
October 9th, 2002. It has now been a full week since the spree of sniper killings began in the D.C. metro area. Most of the attacks have taken place in Maryland, except for one shooting at a Michaels in Spotsylvania, Virginia. But now, the snipers were on the move.
On October 9th, the week following the Montgomery County shootings, a man who worked in an office building in Manassas was out pumping gas not too far from where he worked, a guy named Dean Myers.
This is Dave Statter, reporter for Channel 9 News.
He's on Sudley Road in Prince William County, Virginia, and he's just pumping gas and shot and killed.
Bob Myers, the victim's brother, spoke about the shooting at a press conference.
I would like to know the reason. That would help me. But I recognize that whatever reason it is, it won't be a good one.
This attack sent a ripple through the region. It was the third shooting to take place at a gas station. As Channel 9 reporter Dave Statter points out, now the people of Virginia had a lot to worry about.
This is where you're really starting to notice how cautious people are filling up with gasoline. People are being extremely cautious, and once again, like the people the first day we knew about this, the woman vacuuming her car, the taxi driver who's pumping gas, this happened to Dean Myers. He's filling up with gasoline. So now the real focus is, what do I do when I'm pumping gas? I have to get gasoline for my car. There are gas stations that are starting to put up barricades or tarps to block you. People are ducking around the other side of their vehicle or putting the nozzle into their vehicle and walking away from the vehicle trying to get some sort of cover. So people are clearly scared filling up with gasoline. And this shooting of Dean Myers just added to that fear.
Who could have imagined that somewhere as mundane as a gas station could become the impetus for such crippling fear? I visited the Sunoco station in Manassas, Virginia, where Dean Myers was killed. And the scene brought back some vivid memories from that October in 2002.
Maybe one of the indelible images that I have in my mind from those days, I mean, it really is of seeing the blue tarp that was serving as a bit of a barrier protecting people. So people are pumping gas and they're essentially under, around, behind this blue tarp. And the other thing I recall is hearing stories of cops being asked by folks who needed a fill, hey, I'll give you some extra money to fill up my gas tank because I'm so afraid. I'm afraid to do it myself. Would you take this extra 20 to fill up my gas tank? That sort of speaks to how much fear there was at the time. I think the other thing that we can't imagine today, someone getting away with all of these episodes, all of these attacks, and not clearly being established on some kind of surveillance camera, some kind of CCTV in 2019, come on. You couldn't even attempt something like what we're talking about now, shooting someone dead in a Sunoco gas station. But we're talking about 2002. We're also talking post 9/11. So you're talking about putting more of those systems in place at that point.
We still have officers at the scene searching for evidence, going over it very meticulously.
Police believe they were on the sniper's trail. At a press conference following the Dean Myers shooting, officials revealed what type of vehicle they thought the snipers were using.
The only information we have on a possible vehicle was a white minivan described as a panel vehicle, meaning it had only front passenger windows. The rest was solid.
Officials thought the snipers might still be in the area, so police set up roadblocks on the streets near the crime scene. Nearby parking lots were shut down. No one was allowed to leave. Hundreds of people were stopped and questioned, but no suspects were detained. Officer Stephen Bailey's job was to scout the Bob Evans parking lot for potential witnesses. He remembers approaching one specific vehicle. The driver inside said he was on vacation. This man also said he'd been directed into the parking lot by another officer. Bailey said the man was, quote, very polite and very courteous. And so with no reason to detain him, Bailey let the man leave. It would be months later that Officer Bailey had a terrible realization. The man he met that day was the killer they were looking for.
I think that in a lot of ways is a microcosm of the challenge that was facing everybody.
This is Washington Post reporter Josh White. He told the story of standing near the killer's vehicle at the beginning of the episode. But like Officer Stephen Bailey, he didn't think anything of it at the time.
Nobody knew who they were looking for. Nobody knew what vehicle to look for. Nobody knew the mechanism of the shooting. Was it coming from a car? Was it coming from outside? Ultimately, when they found the vehicle, it was obvious to everyone why the vehicle was so difficult to detect. It was an engineered killing machine. It was built in a way to avoid detection. It was altered in a way that if you were to walk right up to it, you wouldn't think twice. It wouldn't strike you externally as anything to worry about. I thought, I don't know how they're ever going to catch this person. It really showed the vulnerability. It showed that if somebody wants to go after someone who they have no connection to, randomly, in a metropolitan area that has millions of people, what's stopping them? For me, that was one of the scariest moments. That shooting highlighted how difficult this all was and how frightening it all was.
This shooting also marked another major shift in the case. One that greatly raised the stakes for the snipers.
They, I think unbeknownst to them, obviously, they had committed a crime in a county that had one of the more aggressive prosecutors from a capital punishment perspective, Paul Ebert.
It It's a dubious distinction, but a lot of unusual cases have happened in my jurisdiction.
This is Paul Ebert, Virginia's longest-serving prosecutor. I spoke with him at his office in Prince William County. He remembers when Dean Myers was shot in his district.
My daughter, strangely enough, about a half a block from where this happened. When it happened, she was at a bank. I went to the scene like I normally do on a murder case. We don't have that many murders. It helps me to be able to visualize what's going on. A lot of press, a lot of people. The body was gone. Checked around. Of course, it was pretty obvious that the snipers had done this because of the history leading up to it. Anyhow, I had no idea if and when we'd ever get the case to try. And I talked with a couple of reporters that I knew, and I did say that if this is a sniper, it looks like it is, it's a death case. Absent some kind of a great mitigating factor, it was a capital case.
Paul Ebert was issuing a direct threat to the snipers. He went on television that day to say that, quote, "This case, if I have anything to do with it, will be prosecuted in this jurisdiction to the full extent of the law." Ebert has sentenced more inmates to death row than any other Virginia prosecutor. So if the sniper was following the news, they would have known that if caught, they would eventually face the death penalty. The snipers weren't done in Virginia. As the area was still reeling from the death of Dean Harold Myers, tragedy struck once more. Channel 9 reporter Dave Statter was there.
On the morning of October 11th, 2 days after Dean Myers is shot pumping gas in the Manassas area of Virginia, further south in the Fredericksburg area, there's another man shot. 53-year-old Kenneth Bridges, he's shot dead, pumping gasoline at Nexon station. This is just off Interstate 95, a heavily traveled roadway between Richmond and Washington, this portion of I-95. We worked our way down there to just off the highway, and it was difficult getting to that scene. The traffic was just horrendous because the roadway was shut down just off I-95. Police were probably stopping vehicles coming and going. As we're traveling down to the scene, we're being passed by convoys of federal agents heading down there and police from other jurisdictions, trying to get through the same traffic, but they at least have lights and siren. We finally went on to some alternate routes and work our way up to the scene, and we see police. There's tons of police there. We get there, and here we are watching now, which to us is almost eerie and bizarre, yet another person pumping gasoline, shot dead, doing what we all do every day, and the tension is continuing to grow.
Shortly after the crime scene was secured, Virginia police held a press conference. They described how they responded and what they were searching for.
We are looking for a white van that may have had a ladder rack on top of it. We do not, and I stress, we do not know if it was involved in the shooting or not. It was seen in the area by several people, and we do want to talk to those people. We had a Virginia State trooper, uniformed trooper, was across the street from the shooting working the traffic accident. He heard the shots. He ran directly across the street and rendered aid to the victim until the rescue squad arrived. Once at the hospital, the victim was pronounced dead.
The victim, Kenneth Bridges, was a family man. He had 6 children and a wife of 25 years.
Obviously, everyone was devastated at this horrendous act and this horrendous event, losing a loving husband and a strong, giving, caring father. Since that time, however, I have seen the family become stronger and stronger as the hours go by.
Bridges was from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He had just been passing through the D.C. area when his life was tragically cut short. Friends say Bridges was a pillar of his community. He co-founded MATA, a nonprofit company which fosters black-owned businesses.
I'm telling you, this was a near-perfect man. Who loved his family, who loved his people. Kenny was a visionary, a man with great purpose, single-minded purpose, that he had built his entire world around. Ken Bridges has infected thousands and thousands of people all across the country with this vision of his.
The impacts of the D.C. sniper attacks were spreading further and further. Families and communities all across the country had now been affected in various horrible ways.
We're realizing that this thing is not getting smaller, it's not getting narrower, it's getting larger.
This is Channel 9 reporter Dave Statter again.
All along this 95 corridor, people are being attacked. We see it in Montgomery County, Maryland, Prince George's County, Maryland. We're still trying to figure out what's going on. Why is this happening? We're talking to police every day, and it was clear they were having a bit of a time making sense of why these attacks were occurring at these locations. And that just really added to the fear of everybody because nobody could make clear sense of it.
By this point, 10 people had been shot for what seemed like no reason. And the public had very little information to go on. All anyone knew was to be on the lookout for a white van or white box truck. The public was losing confidence in law enforcement's abilities. Police were under tremendous pressure to catch these killers, but nothing seemed to be working. So what was their plan?
We had strategies. I mean, I started out and I had a mission.
This is Drew Tracy, retired assistant chief of police for Montgomery County.
We had to protect our first responders. We had to protect the citizens, but we also had to have that investigative role and that ability to stop what was going on. And that was our mission.
But how would they find the shooters? Tracy says they employed a tactic known as a dragnet. It starts with police creating a large perimeter around a crime scene to ensnare any potential suspects.
We actually had circles that we put on a map. So if a shooting went out, we knew that vehicle could only go in 15 or 20 minutes so far. So we tried to slow things down, slow it by slowing traffic, almost type of roadblocks. And what we did is we had immediate action teams. We need to be on scene in 2 to 3 minutes of any critical incident or possible incident. Then we worked on predetermined roles. I went over a game plan and showed if the shooting is within this district, here's everybody's predetermined location they had to go to. And then what we would do is bring in air support. We'd get plainclothes units who look like normal people, try to get closer in to try to pick out a suspect or a vehicle. So then we could bring in the tactical officers and utilize a takedown in a safe way so we wouldn't put people in danger. The thing that I think was, I know for a fact was really holding us back is we didn't get good suspect information. They would put out multiple lookouts because people would just scatter from a certain area and you had vehicles going in every direction and no one knew exactly if one was involved or not. So we had a pretty good game plan, but the problem was we weren't being provided good intelligence and suspect information from lookout. That hurt us.
One incident directly after the shooting of Kenneth Bridges highlights this issue. Police searched nearby motels looking for a suspect. They had a somewhat fuzzy picture of the suspect from a security camera. And with a description from that, police detained and questioned a man at one of the motels. But it was quickly determined he wasn't the sniper. And so by the end of the day, no viable suspects had been arrested. As the shooting spread further from D.C., nearby jurisdictions were biding their time, fearful that at any moment, an attack would happen in their area.
I was absolutely sure that we were going to get a shooting. My name is Bruce Guth. I'm a retired lieutenant from Fairfax County Police Department in Virginia. Fairfax is 400 square miles. We have 1.2 million people. And I was sure we were going to get hit sooner or later. Sure enough, on October 14th, one of my guys who was working called me on my cell phone and said, "Hey, I think we just had a sniper shooting down at the Home Depot, which is the Falls Church area of Fairfax County, which is right at the border of Arlington County and Fairfax County." He said that a woman had been shot in the head underneath the parking garage.
The victim was 47-year-old FBI analyst Linda Franklin. She was loading shopping bags into the trunk of her car right before she was shot. Linda was with her husband, Ted Franklin. who then called 911 in distress. A warning. The following audio could be upsetting to some listeners.
Where are you at?
I'm at the Home Depot.
Home Depot?
On Route 50.
Route 50?
Yes.
Your wife is shot?
Yes.
Where has she been shot?
She shot in the head.
Okay.
So I got in my car and I drove down to Falls Church. I was one of the first detectives there. My first memory was the smell of diesel fuel from the ambulance. There was an ambulance parked underneath the parking garage. Inside the ambulance was Mr. Franklin. They had put him in there. Obviously, he was quite distraught. It was a catastrophic head injury that he witnessed, and he had been spattered with blood.
Channel 9 reporter Dave Statter also rushed to the scene.
After a long day of working on the sniper case on October 14th, my pager goes off. It's my colleague Greg Geis telling me there's a shooting right up the street at the Home Depot at the top of our street. I race up to the top of the street in my car, come into the shopping center, and apparently I came in from the opposite side of police and fire, and I go into this covered parking area outside the Home Depot, and I pull up, and I see a grocery cart, and it's full of stuff. And I look down from that grocery cart, and there's a woman's body lying on the pavement. Her head is covered with some kind of yellow sheet. And I realize, well, I'm way too close. And I immediately pull out to just outside the covered area, and there are police running with police tape to secure the scene. But I pulled out my home video camera, and you see in my first video the ambulance pull up and go up to look at Ms. Franklin's body. And the next thing I see are police officers running with their guns drawn across Route 50, a six-lane highway, to an apartment complex across the street where there's a white vehicle that looks sort of like a box truck. They have their guns drawn on what turned out to be painters who were coming out of the apartment building, and they put their hands up immediately.
The painters were just in the wrong place at the wrong time, so police let them go.
We were reporting. I went live on the air with a phone report because I didn't have a live TV truck with me and no other crews were there. We broke into coverage with what appeared to be another shooting. Police obviously had a plan for the next shooting. They shut down a good portion of the Capitol Beltway that brings Washington, D.C. They wanted to make sure that they could get the vehicle. And the lookout that they knew they were looking for that evening was a white box truck. They shut down Route 50. They shut down 495-95. And it created an enormous traffic jam that evening.
According to Virginia Detective Bruce Guth, it was quickly clear to them that this was a sniper shooting, and they had limited time to catch the vehicle before it was too late.
I don't think there was a soul in law enforcement that didn't think for a second that it wasn't them. It was clear that it was a somewhat long-range shot. We had our SWAT team put a perimeter up around where we were to kind of protect us while we were working the crime scene. We had pre-planned that.
Once again, the night ended with no real suspects. But perhaps for the first time, law enforcement had a viable witness who said he'd seen not just a vehicle, but the actual shooter. The witness was a man named Matthew Dowdy.
And he described a vehicle, and he said the guy was leaning out, like on the driver's side mirror. He saw the rifle, saw the shot go off. He was inside the parking lot. This guy we had to investigate and had two detectives take him back to the station and get a statement from him. You know, that was the first lead where someone had actually seen somebody. That next day after the murder, we had a debrief with Montgomery County and all the other jurisdictions.
Virginia officials shared the specific details of Matthew Dowdy's story. He said he saw an olive-skinned man step out of a cream-colored van. The man then shot Franklin with an AK assault rifle. Dowdy said the man then got back into the van and drove away. Dowdy described the vehicle as a Chevy Astro van with a broken taillight.
And I'll never forget this, Chief Moose. 10 minutes into it, we were trying to get everybody settled in, and he waved me over and he sat down and he goes, "You are absolutely nuts for having this meeting and putting out all you're going to put out. You know, as much as everybody's leaking, all this stuff is going to get out, that there's a witness." And I said, "Well, you know, that's just the way it is, because I'm not holding back information from other homicide detectives. And, you know, we'll take our lumps. If it leaks, it leaks, and, you know, we'll deal with it." But I'll never forget him shaking his head like, "You're crazy." But we made up our mind. You know, we were going to share whatever we had with surely the homicide detectives that we were dealing with. And they had helped us in the past with other cases. So there were people I could trust.
This incident was especially puzzling to investigators. Had the sniper specifically targeted an FBI agent? If so, was this shooting some sort of message sent to law enforcement that not even they were safe? Up to this point, there had been nothing to suggest that these attacks were anything but random. But now investigators were unsure. On top of all this, the witness, Matthew Doughty, described the suspect as an olive-skinned man with an AK. This reinforced the notion that the snipers were potentially terrorists from the Middle East. But profilers had determined by this point that that was incredibly unlikely. So what was going on here?
My thought process was maybe different than some others. What's going through my mind, not what I'm reporting, but what I'm thinking clearly at that time, is that this is some sort of international terrorism. Because what I'm quickly realizing is that with a few bullets and a vehicle, somebody is shutting down commerce in the area, panicking hordes of people in and around the nation's capital. And I'm thinking, here we are a year after 9/11, this is likely some sort of international terrorism. That's just a gut I had from watching it. You know, if you live in Israel or a place where there's lots of bombings and car bombs and bombs on buses and in restaurants, you live a certain way and you're used to it. We're not used to that in the Washington area, where there's a lot of random shootings where people are just shot doing their routine business. So it's just going through my mind, what an unusual way to shut us down and to really impact us.
Channel 9 reporter Dave Statter kept up with the Linda Franklin story for the next few days, hoping that the witness identification might lead to a break in the case.
The next morning, they continued doing the lookouts for the white van, more stopping of white vans, white box trucks. But they find out soon that the information they got was bad.
In suburban Virginia today, where the killer last struck, a frantic search for clues, touched off by a phony witness's confession last night that his story, that he'd seen the killer, his van, his gun, was all a lie. And Task Force Leader Chief Charles Moose was especially worried about that.
Maybe we didn't hear from some people because they saw that picture and they said, the person I was thinking about doesn't have one of those.
You can see in the back of my video, a gentleman in the video that I didn't realize who he was till later. It's a guy named Matthew Doughty. He was 37 years old at the time. And Matthew Doughty said he witnessed the shooting of Linda Franklin at the Home Depot. And what he said was a white box truck sped from the scene. Police investigated further Matthew Doughty's claim, and what they determined was that Matthew Doughty, thanks to security camera video they could tell, was still inside the store when Linda Franklin was shot. He was not outside the store in the parking lot area where this occurred, in the covered parking area. And they quickly discounted his information. Matthew Doughty, they also found out, had a long criminal record. He, like others, had heard of the white box truck in the news. It was prominently out there, and thought he would interject himself in the case. Why he did it, I don't know, other than I'm sure he didn't have a lot of love for police, because he had a long criminal record and actually had escaped from jail or prison many years earlier in another charge. Not too long after the shooting of Linda Franklin, the police chief of Fairfax County, Tom Manger, held a press conference and said they had the wrong information. Made it very clear that they were charging this person who gave him the wrong information, apologized for letting the public in on this information, and it was a bit of a setback for this case. An interesting note about Matthew Doughty: about 2 years later, and a mile and a half away, he murdered and raped a woman at a motel in the city of Falls Church, Virginia, and was arrested and convicted for that murder. So his criminal activity continued after providing bogus information to police at the Home Depot shooting.
Following this incident, journalists and police alike began to doubt earlier witness accounts. What if the first description of a white box truck was false, and police were on a wild goose chase? Some experts came forward with ideas.
At the time of the DC sniper case, I was following the events just as anyone else was. I tended to look at them a little bit differently, I think, because I've been doing this research. My name is Gary Wells. I'm a professor of psychology at Iowa State University, and my main line of study is the reliability of eyewitnesses. So I'm looking at it differently, and I'm looking for what are witnesses going to be able to tell. Really, people process a lot less information than we think. When they scan in their environment, they're really only taking in a very small fraction of information. They get this sense that they're seeing everything when in fact they're seeing very little. And so, therefore, a lot doesn't get stored. Moreover, we now know that memory changes some over time. You take in new information and you kind of stick it in with what you remembered, and now you've got a new memory. So I guess my biggest interest and concern was how the investigators of the DC sniper shootings were proceeding here. And I was particularly concerned about this relatively early report about a white truck or a white van. The reason I was concerned about that was because I thought it was premature. I didn't think that law enforcement, under the circumstances, should have given much credibility to that report. Somehow, the investigators decided to release that information and, in effect, sort of say, we're looking for a white van. I think that was a huge mistake. There's two reasons to really be concerned about that. One is that you're creating a situation in which it's very difficult for law enforcement to win this game. If it was a white van, then you can pretty much guarantee that this person's going to switch vehicles because they're onto the white van. We can't do that. If, on the other hand, it wasn't a white van, that gives a lot of cover, a lot of comfort to the shooters, because it's sort of like, they have no idea what they're looking at, right? So you just gave them permission to continue with their standard MO because everybody's looking for a white van. From a witness perspective, it's a particularly bad thing to do, because it turns out I did a little bit of homework at the time to find out that white vans are pretty close to the most common vehicle on the road in urban environments. And the reason they are is because they're so often used as service vehicles. So, you know, those appliance repairmen and those roofers and those plumbers and all these companies are driving all over the place in white vans. So what happens then is, as soon as you discover there's been a shooting and you look around, you'll always see a white van. So, of course, the next shooting, white van. Next shooting, somebody reports white van. Of course, somebody's always going to report a white van in any urban setting. You're taking away their opportunity to see anything other than a white van at that point, and everybody knew to be looking for that. I think that was a pretty bad mistake.
But if not a white van or white box truck, then what? Had police seen any other vehicles at the crime scenes?
You know, I'll never understand that. How did they rule out all other vehicles? And they being police departments, FBI, officials, everyone.
This is Greg Geis, a photographer and videographer for Channel 9 News. On October 3rd, the second day of the shootings, Greg was covering the attacks.
I was with reporter Gary Reels. We're driving southbound on Connecticut Avenue. I kept the fire and EMS dispatch channels locked on several different radios. And what will stick with me forever are two different police officers in two different cars key their mic and say, You know, I see this dark-colored Crown Vic or Capri, sort of an old police-looking vehicle driving with no lights on, heading north. And I turned to the right and said to reporter Gary Reels, I wonder if the sniper's driving a war wagon or a hoopty. A war wagon being a term used for old cars that are sometimes used in gang-like violence by some of what at the time were called crews in the Washington area. And a hoopty being just an old junk car that are often used sometimes by folks who've stolen a car for a joyride or somebody who's using a stolen vehicle to commit a crime. I left that evening with the feeling that in some way, a dark, older model, police-style sedan may have been involved in these crimes. The powers that be arrived at the fact that they're looking for a white box truck. I never bought into that. Everything I heard indicated a dark old model sedan. And we would engage in conversation, different officers and myself, and I would relay that story about the older vehicles that I heard from Metropolitan Police in Washington. And the cops were perplexed that they never got that information. They never heard the nuance of the cops keying their mic and, if you will, flashing a lookout for what they viewed were suspicious vehicles leaving a scene.
In a press conference, Montgomery County Police Chief Charles Moose conceded, maybe the white box truck identification was a misfire.
It's not beyond any reality that the person or people involved in this would have numerous vehicles that they could be using.
If law enforcement had missed the drop on other suspect vehicles, what else could they have missed? Little did they know the shooters had actually been trying to contact them for the past week. The day after the Linda Franklin shooting, the police in Rockville, Maryland, got a phone call from the snipers.
Good morning. Where are the people that are causing the killing in your area? Look on the terror card. It says, call me God. Do not release the press.
Next time on Monster, DC Sniper.
The first time that this area so far south has been brought into what seems to be another case of a serial sniper attack.
When I arrived, our victim was laying in the parking lot, and his wife was sitting on the sidewalk and had her husband's head in her lap.
To the rear of where the shell casing was found, there was some type of message that was attached to a tree.
Do not release to the press. 5 red stars. You have our terms. They are non-negotiable.
No self-respecting terrorist is going to do that, number one. Number two, we finally get a demand.
At that point, the sniper task force took this information and followed it up, and the pieces began to fall into place.
Monster, DC Sniper is a 15-episode podcast hosted by Tony Harris and produced by iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV. Matt Frederick and Alex Williams are executive producers on behalf of iHeartRadio, alongside producers Trevor Young, Ben Kiebrick, and Josh Thane. Payne Lindsay and Donald Albright are executive producers on behalf of Tenderfoot TV, alongside producers Meredith Stedman and Christina Dana. Original music is by Makeup and Vanity Set. If you haven't already, be sure to check out the first 2 seasons, Atlanta Monster and Monster the Zodiac Killer. If you have questions or comments, email us at monster@iheartmedia.com, or you can call us at 1-833-285-6667. Thanks for listening.